सार्वस्वं जलदाहित्वा विरेजु सुब्रवर्चसा यथात्यक्त्यायश नाशन्ता मुनयो मुक्तकिल्बिषा.
The clouds, having given up all they possessed, shone forth with purified effulgence. Just like peaceful sages who have given up all material desires and are thus free of all sinful propensities. Report. When the clouds are filled with water, they are dark and cover the sun's rays. Just as the material mind of an impure man covers the soul shining within. But when the clouds pour down their rain, they become white and then brilliantly reflect the shining sun. Just as a man who gives up all material desires and sinful propensities becomes purified and then brilliantly reflects his own soul and the supreme soul within.
Girayo mumutus toyam. Pachinna mumuchu sivam yatha jnanamritam kale jnanino dadate nava.
During this season, the mountains sometimes released their pure water and sometimes did not, just as experts in transcendental knowledge sometimes give the nectar of transcendental knowledge and sometimes do not. Purport. The first part of this chapter described the rainy season, and the second part has been dealing with the autumn season, which begins when the rain stops. During the rainy season, water always flows from the mountains, but during the autumn, the water sometimes flows and sometimes does not. Similarly, great saintly teachers sometimes speak expansively on spiritual knowledge, and sometimes they are silent. The self-realized soul is closely in touch with the Supreme Lord, and according to his desires, a competent spiritual scientist may or may not describe the absolute truth, depending on the specific circumstances.
In the verse that we are reading this morning, Srila Shukadeva Goswami is comparing the clouds of the autumn season. During the rainy season, the clouds are black. They are filled with great abundances of rain or water. But in the autumn season, they are pure white. They have given up what is explained here, all that they have possessed. And they are no longer dark, but they are shining forth with purified effulgence. And this is compared to peaceful sages who have given up all material desires and who are thus free from all sinful propensities. Really, the mind, the heart, is like this type of cloud. And we have filled our minds with so many designations, and on the basis of these designations, so many attachments. And these attachments are like a very heavy, heavy weight, and they create a great darkness. A darkness that obstructs the vision of God, the Paramatma, as well as the very Jivatma within our own hearts. And due to these material attachments and all of the conceptions that we identify with. From time to time, so many terrible storms come into our life. Sometimes they are caused by the circumstances around us, and sometimes they are caused by our very body and mind themselves. In this way, the cloud of material attachment is constantly harassing the pure soul who is by nature part and parcel of Krishna. And it is very, very difficult, practically impossible, to free oneself from these attachments. But it is described that through the process of bhakti, the first thing that we must endeavor to do, as Rupa Goswami explains, we must accept what is favorable for devotional service, and we must reject what is unfavorable. Now, practically speaking, what that means in our life is what we have to accept is the few sacred instructions of our spiritual master. But what we have to reject is practically everything our whole conception of reality is based upon. We have to detach ourselves from practically everything we have addicted ourselves to throughout our life and previous lives. And it is a very difficult thing. Therefore, here it is explained that in order to be peaceful, you have to become like the autumn cloud that has given up all of its rain, given up everything. In other words, to give up all material desires, to be free from them. Materialistic people, they consider their material desires to be their great wealth. They're constantly feeding those desires, nourishing those desires, encouraging those desires. When we go to school, when we go to college, what do they teach you? Simply how wonderful material desires are and how to feed them, how to make them stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger unlimitedly. And in most families, this is the whole principle that the family is based upon. Satisfying material desires. Work hard, arrange nice material facilities for the family, marry them into a nice material arrangement. This way the whole consciousness is just based on expanding our material desires. And it is like such a heavy weight. The more we expand our material desires and the facilities to enjoy our material propensities, the more we are just putting an incredible, immense weight on our very mind. And it becomes such a burden. Srila Prabhupada uses the example of the man who's carrying such a huge burden on his right shoulder. And somebody says to him, and Krishna appears to him. Krishna appears to this man. He says, I will bestow whatever benediction you like. If you like, I will take your burden. He said, no. My right shoulder is so sore, it is so weary, it is so tired. Please, my Lord, if you want to grant me a benediction, help me shift it to my left shoulder. This is material life. We're so attached to this burden. Prabhupada also uses the example of a man who has a useless pile of material possessions which are like rocks, and he's swimming across the river trying to bring it to the other side, and he's drowning because of the weight. It's forcing him down. And people are calling to him, just let go. Just let go and you can easily swim across. But he refuses to let go. He's so much attached to it, he refuses to let go. And ultimately is the cause of his very death. Srimad Bhagavatam explains the same thing. That great, great wealthy kings, they wear big, big heavy crowns. The heavier the crown, the better. The heavier the crown, that means the more the jewels, the more gold, the more costly. But if that king is drowning in an ocean, the crown will only make him sink faster. But yet he can't give it up. He won't give it up. Similarly, all of our material attachments are like a burden which is causing us so much anxiety, so much frustration. The more you have, the more you need to maintain what you have. It's an endless cycle. Huh? We spend our whole life just protecting the facilities that are supposed to be for our use. We become the slaves of the things that are supposed to be helping us. We become so infatuated. Huh? The more complicated your life becomes, the more endlessly you forget Krishna, because you're so much enwrapped in just trying to maintain and preserve all of what you have. It is a fact. Therefore, simple living, high thinking means just have the basics. Have what you need. Have what you require. Have what you can best utilize in God's service. And then you can use your mind and your intelligence to be cultivating your spiritual life and doing good seva to others. Otherwise, I need this, I need this, and I need this, and you struggle so hard to get it, and then when you have it, it's like a rope around your neck. And then you just constantly pulling and pulling and pulling. The more you have, the more you have to work and work and work and work simply to maintain that. Such a heavy weight. What to speak of protecting it. And the more you have, the more you're afraid to lose. But really, what do we need? What do we require? Therefore, it is explained here that freedom is when you're no longer attached to any of these things. It's as simple as that. In this material world, there's so many perverted conceptions of freedom. Just like here in India. At one time you were under Mughal rule, at one time under British rule. And then finally, freedom. But what kind of freedom? Here we are. We have freedom. We have our own flag with our own colors. We have our own constitution. We have our own parliament. Huh? But you're not even allowed to walk outside. You're not even allowed to go to the store to buy vegetables. Huh? If you go out, you break curfew, you may be shot to death, you may be stabbed to death. You may be burned to death. This is freedom. Freedom to burn each other and stab each other and kill each other. Huh? This is freedom. Similarly, in the United States of America, we were also under British rule. We all have something in common. And then the Revolutionary War. And then freedom. Stars and stripes forever. And then what? You go any city. People are afraid to walk outside their doors. They have all sorts of security lock systems and bars in their windows and security guards. Huh? This is freedom? What to speak of their own internal state of consciousness? So much anxiety, so much frustration, so much disappointment. People are dying around us. We're getting sick, we're getting diseased. Our business, so much anxiety. Is this freedom? According to the Bhagavatam, freedom is freedom from attachment. When you're freed from attachment, you're liberated. But as long as we have attachments, no matter what material arrangement we have, we are like slaves of those attachments. We're bound. We are simply subjugated by Maya and by the propaganda of this world. That is why Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, in his first meeting with Srila Prabhupada, he told him that Krishna consciousness is the only solution. God consciousness is the only solution to the problems of this world. And the only one single problem in this world is a lack of Krishna consciousness. Because we are not Krishna conscious, whatever situation, whether we're a dependent state or an independent state, whether we're prosperous economically or whether we're in a great depression, whatever the situation is externally, where there's a lack of Krishna consciousness, there's bondage, suffering, and anxiety. And where there's Krishna consciousness, there's freedom, there's liberation. So therefore, rather than trying to store more and more and more of these complications in our mind and our heart, if we want to find real peace, we have to release it all. We have to, as it is explained, we have to give it up, all material desires, and be free from all sinful propensities. In this way, Shukadeva Goswami is giving us so much wonderful, wonderful contemplative meditations. Whenever we see a cloud in the sky, whenever we see a rain cloud, we should think, this is like the mind that is so full and so heavy and so dark. Such a heavy weight, filled with material desires. And when we see the autumn cloud, the white cloud, we think, oh, this is like a free, liberated sage whose mind has found peace because has given up all material attachments, all material desires. And then it is explaining in the next verse that during this autumn season, sometimes mountains release their pure water and sometimes they do not. Just as experts in transcendental science sometimes give the nectar of transcendental knowledge and sometimes do not. This is a very important sloka. It is explaining a mature, it is said, an expert in transcendental science. A mature preacher of Sanatana Dharma knows when to speak and when not to speak. An immature devotee is oftentimes self-righteous, fanatical, speaks because it must be said. Speaks because if I don't say it, then if I do not say it, then I am not properly representing God and people will never understand And what will people think of me if I do not defend the philosophy and like that? Huh? But a devotee should know that we only speak when it's for the benefit of others. And oftentimes not speaking is more beneficial than speaking. We speak only to enlighten a person. We do not speak to defeat a person. If defeating means enlightening, then we will defeat. But if defeating simply means making that person go away, thinking, oh, I am defeated. I don't like these people. I don't like this movement. They are very... they have defeated me. Then what is the use? Oftentimes a preacher preaches more on behalf of his own ego than he does on behalf of God. Sometimes just to show how brilliant we are, how intelligent we are, how Krishna conscious we are, we want to defeat others. We want to preach and show how much we know. But a devotee is free from those. A devotee should aspire to be free from those propensities. Just like a medical doctor. The worst doctors are the ones that will just give you heavy medicines for anything. Right? And although the person will give him his good money and think, oh, this is a very good doctor because he's giving me heavy medicines, this must be what I need, he's actually killing the patient. He's actually making things worse. What do you say, Adhikesha? There are doctors like this? There are surgeons who, any little thing, you need surgery. Actually, you're destroying that person's life. But just to show how much I know, how much I can do to make business better. But a sensitive doctor is one who gives you the minimal medicine he can get by with, but give you what you need. In the same way, when we preach Krishna consciousness, we should be very, very enthusiastic that according to a person's submissiveness, according to a person's capacity to assimilate and understand, we give them as much Krishna consciousness as we can. But if we see that a person cannot digest it, has no capacity to properly understand it, or if he will simply misunderstand, then a devotee simply gives what that person needs. Just like oftentimes devotees ask how to preach to parents. Generally, the best way to preach to parents is to say nothing at all about Krishna consciousness except some basic things. Because the more you talk, the more they think you're a fanatic, the more they think you're brainwashed, the more they think you're disrespectful, and they won't listen to anything. In most cases, this is the case. But if you just say, oh, Haribo, how are you? I'm very happy being a devotee. Here's some prasad. Then, oh, this must be a good movement. But if you start saying, you are a Mayavadi, and if you don't surrender to Krishna, you're going to hell, and you're not this body, and the laws of karma are upon you, and Krishna's first expansion is Mahavishnu, who's so big that millions and billions and trillions of universes are coming out of his body, and when he exhales and then when he inhales, they all go inside, and like this. And besides that, we never went to the moon. If you preach like this to your parents, they'll think these people are these. What have they done to my child? They've brainwashed him. You say, Haribo, this is very nice. I am very happy. They're feeding me good. I'm in good health. And after all, we are not this body. We're servants of Krishna. That's all. Very nice. Very nice. He still likes me. Right? So we must understand, what is the best thing for that person? What is the best dose of medicine for that person? We should not be self-righteous. We should be compassionate. Therefore, just like we find Jad Bharat. Jad Bharat, what a good preacher he was. His brothers, they were so puffed up, he knew they wouldn't listen to him. He said nothing to them. And Maharaj Rahugna, he said nothing to him either. Until it came to the point where Maharaj Rahugna was in a condition of material consciousness where Jad Bharat knew, now if I speak, he will become enlightened. And then he spoke. And how much he spoke. He spoke chapters of knowledge of the Bhagavatam to him. But only at the right time. So in a similar way, we must learn that sometimes simply our example is the best preacher. And sometimes our word is the best preaching. We must become very sensitive. And of course this comes through realization. We have to use our good intelligence, but ultimately a good preacher is one who has realization. People can quote hundreds and thousands of slokas and know books upon books and books of philosophy. But when they preach, sometimes they offend people. They turn people away from Krishna consciousness. Right? Because they have all jnan, but not realization. We have seen Srila Prabhupada. We have seen devotees preaching for days and weeks and months to somebody and not convince them, but create more doubt in their mind. We've seen Prabhupada in one sentence convince a person. The same person. Huh? Because he spoke with realization. It's a fact. So really, to become a good preacher, we have to become self-realized. We have to become purified. We have to learn to be the servant of the servant. We have to learn to be submissive to our guru. First, we have to learn to sit and patiently hear. Then we can speak nicely. Srila Prabhupada used to tell us, Bhakti Siddhanta would say about him often, that because this boy likes to sit and listen, hear nicely, therefore he will speak perfectly. When Srila Prabhupada was before his guru, he just would sit and listen. Just hear, so submissive. Very quietly, just hear. Wasn't anxious to speak as much as he was to hear. And then what he did speak had so much realization. Sometimes we speak all gossip, we speak all criticism, we speak all nonsense about others. But at the same time, we love to preach. That means when you do preach, you have already drained all your potency in everything else you've said. But when you're silent, and you just hear, and you just act, then when you do preach the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, it has power, it has potency, it has strength. So in this way, we have to, by hearing from mature preachers, by witnessing how they are preaching, and by following in their footsteps and following their instructions, gradually we become purified, we become realized. And then when we preach, it has tremendous power, tremendous potency. Is there any questions? Yes?
But we say that it's a fact that the more and more we have a material desire, we have more and more problems in our head. And as and when the material desire is less, we are somewhat peaceful. The problem for us is when everything is going on right now in Bombay, we feel it that the less we have material desire, we'll be much more peaceful, because these things are unnecessarily creating more problems. If we had some property, if we had some wealth, we'll be more in anxiety because anything can be destructed at any moment. But once everything is calm and cool, everything is going on very smoothly, at those persons who had a wealth and who had a property, they are making more progress. And when we see that they are making more progress, we feel it disturbed that something has gone wrong, actually. Because I was having less material desire, I was completely lacking behind. And my business associates and all those people, they worked like a donkey. And now they are working, they are making a good progress. They are having a very luxurious life and everything. Because they made some suffering in the last past time, they are making a good progress. And I was in the same predicament where I was before. So at that time, because we are at a neophyte stage, we have not realized it, that this material desire is a very worst thing. And when we see something is going out very nicely at that time, we are disturbed. So how to have the full conviction that this is not going to help us anyway?
Come to Srimad Bhagavatam class as much as possible. Because hearing is the means by which we understand what is truth. We should see through our ears, not through our eyes. We may see a person's particular situation, but when we hear from the Shastra and hear from God, we understand what his situation actually is. Lord Jesus said, there was a follower, not a follower, but someone came to Jesus, a very wealthy man, and says, "Lord, I want to follow you." Jesus said, "All right, you give everything away and then you come and follow me. Give everything you have away and then you come only with the clothes you're wearing and come to follow me." And he became very disturbed, this man, and left for good. Huh? And Jesus said to his disciples when they saw this, he said, "It is easier to thread a camel through an eye of a needle than for a man attached to his wealth to enter into the kingdom of God." Doesn't mean we can't have wealth. We cannot be attached to it. So is the goal of life material or spiritual? If the goal of life is material, then better to amass as much as you can. But if the goal of life is spiritual, then you must understand that this person is just putting more and more of a burden into his life. Therefore, we do not envy them, but we pity them. We feel sorrow and compassion for them. These people, on the front page of Fortune magazine and everything, the materialistic people envy them like anything. But the devotee feels such sympathy and sorrow for them. Such a pitiable condition. So caught up in so many mundane affairs. Such a weight. So much immorality. Such a burden. Like in the West, men like to have big muscles. Women like to have big breasts. So they put all these artificial injections, steroids and everything. Huh? You have heard of these steroids? Huh? Silicone steroid. And then they become very strong and very shapely, and they're very beautiful. And people think, oh, how wonderful. Look at your big muscles. Oh, how nice. Huh? But actually, it's killing them. Internally, it's killing them. It causes all terrible diseases, cancers, and everything else. It's killing them. But yet they just want to appear like this. Huh? So a lusty woman will look at this man and say, oh, look at your big, wonderful muscles. And a sane person would think, God, what an unfortunate soul. He's going to die of cancer. Huh? What is the use? Hmm? Similarly, all these Matajis, so many of them are dying of cancer because they... So immediately people are saying, oh, you are so shapely and beautiful. I want to be with you. But then when the cancer strikes, nobody wants to be with you. They'll desert you, reject you. So a devotee sees from the very beginning that this is going to kill you. This is going to cause you pain and torture and suffering. But at the beginning, it's going to cause all sorts of popularity and sense enjoyment. Huh? So a devotee sees through the guise of the illusion. Not envious of such a person. Feel sorrow for such a crazy, foolish person. So what is the difference? Amassing big, big wealth in this world is just like putting steroids in your body. Huh? You look big and strong and you can impress so many people and you can get so much gratification out of it. But in the end, it's just like a terrible, incurable disease that's going to cause you to suffer and die. Huh? Unless we do it for Krishna, honestly, then however much wealth comes, then it is auspicious. So you should not be impressed by such crazy fellows. Yes?
Maharaj, with your permission, I'd like to comment on this.
Yes, please.
You see, I was reading a biography of one of the world's richest men, a man called John D. Rockefeller. You heard his name? He was the world's largest oil refinery owner, processor, and so on. So he worked very, very hard, extremely hard, as a young man, to become the world's number one rich man. And in his biography it is written that he got so much wealth, he got so much control of US, American, worldwide oil industry, that the whole American government became its enemy. And they brought a law called the antitrust law to break up his empire, because the American government thought one day he will compete with us. At this stage, he was so upset that the American government was breaking up his whole empire into California Oil Company and Ohio Oil Company, that's called Sohio, and so on and so forth, New Jersey Oil Company. They had to break it up because that's the law. They brought a law that his digestion process stopped. He could not digest any food. At this stage, the best doctors of the world, because he had all the money in the world, he had the best doctors of New York, Zurich, Vienna, they visited him. So what's wrong with this man? Why he can't eat anything? He can't retain any food, nothing.
Couldn't even drink his oil.
He couldn't even, he could never drink. And his oil he could not even look at. He would vomit. So finally one doctor thought, better make him drink mother's milk.
mother's milk.
Yes, because nothing else he can digest. So they got hold of a black negress nurse, whom he would never, I mean, you know, John D. Rockefeller would never even look at that type of woman. He had to submit to drinking her milk because he couldn't get milk from anyone else. No woman. He was an old man. He was very, very old, and he was looking like a Scrooge. You know this Charles Dickens book, Scrooge? So if you read his biography, I would humbly request you to read biography of all the rich people, not rich, richest people of the world. And each one of them, because I was very fond of wealth, I was very fond of progress, I was very fond of position, very fond of, you know, being the top in my line sort of thing. Each one of them have suffered so much so, they have been humiliated. Just imagine, you cannot eat, you cannot drink anything. And then this big black woman comes, "Okay, John D., here it is." And she pulls up her blouse. "Go for it." It must be so humiliating for this man. And that was the only way he could survive. And then he died. And when he died, all his relations were fighting with each other on his will, because each one thought that he should have gotten more. So not only he was unhappy during his life, whatever he left after his life was a total chaos in the family.
Who got the nurse?
So that's John D. Rockefeller. Another man called Paul J. Getty, another big Gulf Oil Company. You've heard of Gulf Oil Company? So I told you, when I'm in this industry, I like to read all these books. Oh, I used to read all these books. So same story. I've got his book and I've got photocopies. I give it to my friends like you. Then, my dear friend, just read this. Now, we are nothing. In India, there is not one company which falls in the first 100 of the world. There is not one company. There may be one or two government companies which fall in the first 500. And there is no possibility for us to be in that first 100. So let's forget about being, you know, too rich or too this or too that, because we won't reach there. Okay? At least in India, there is possibility of our being the first 100 devotees. If we want to compete, we want to have a position, we want to reach somewhere, they cannot beat us on one subject, and that is the spiritual subject. Because Prabhupada says that India is meant for, and Indians are born, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself says, we are supposed to excel in this industry. Call it an industry if you wish. Call it a profession if you wish. Call it what you want. But you are supposed to do this. This is why you were born here to start with. So why not become the topmost in this line? I come to this conclusion or realization after 53 years. Now similarly, I have read about Mr. Kaiser, who was America's very big steel producer. If you read about Henry Ford, who was a car producer. If you talk about Japanese, Matsushita, an electrical producer. Each one of them, Maharaj, have gone through the same phase. Now it's too much of a coincidence that people in different parts of the world, Rothschild, you are in finance and banking industry. You just go through his biography. All the Rothschild children were fighting with each other. You see? So how much pain it gives to the grandfather when the children and grandchildren are fighting so much amongst themselves. How much pain it gives. You see? Instead, if you have a goal which a right-minded person has, that this is enough for me, this is what I need. Little more than maybe what you need. Alright, 10% more, 20% more, maybe 100% more. I keep with myself. I keep this much reserve. And the rest, let me spend my time and energy. And one has to think in these terms in the long run. Otherwise you'll end up sucking milk from a negress.
Ha, 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 ha.
Any other questions?
Maharaj, we have heard that this Rockefeller had some realization at a very early age that he came into the TV and he was giving some class. He was giving something, and by which you got a realization that this Rockefeller, when he lost his son, and then he gave some realization in the TV that I'll be just a very mercy, means I'll be very dead, like a dead. He gave some realization in the TV that I'll be just a very mercy, means I'll be very dead, like a dead person for the whole of my life because I've lost my child. And due to that, you also got some realization. Can you share that actually?
I think that was a different one of the Rockefellers, but same. I think it was him, yeah. He's one of them. I was a little boy, I read it in the paper. It was also on TV, he was interviewed. His son was eaten by cannibals. In New Guinea. Instead of those same race, instead of giving milk, they ate him instead. Family karma, I guess. But he was working on his master's degree in anthropology, and he was doing a thesis, maybe his PhD, in New Guinea, studying the life and habits of the man-eating cannibals. And while he was there, he had all guards and security and everything, but he was on a ship going back to this boat, and the ship some difficulty, so they had to all go back by land individually. They had to swim. And they never found him again. They ultimately discovered that he was eaten. Can you imagine your son being eaten alive? So he was so morose. He said, with all my wealth, with all my power, with all my prestige, with everything I have, he says, I will never see a moment of happiness again in my life because my son is dead. He was utterly frustrated. He was weeping, he was crying. He was devastated. So what is the use of all this money? One little thing goes wrong beyond your control and you're miserable for the rest of your life. Any other questions? One more. Yes?
As you're talking about the profession, like doctors prescribing drugs, but the thing is, most of them, they want to be cheated. If you are truthful, they start suspecting you that you are not giving proper advice. The condition is such that people want to be cheated. They believe in that. Like someone is giving them costly drugs, they're asking for investigation, unnecessary investigation. They have more faith in that doctor. But if you try to be truthful and tell them that you don't need medicine, most of them, they don't need treatment, then they start looking at you very suspiciously.
It is the world of the cheaters and the cheated. Because people want to be cheated, Krishna sends so many cheaters. But we are, Prabhupada said exactly that. You will never find masses of people coming to this movement. Because the masses of people always want to be cheated. And they want to find the cheater who will give them what they want. But a devotee only speaks the truth. A devotee will never cheat.
He will simply speak the truth.
Maharaj, I don't know I'm right or wrong, but we have a feeling that amongst our congregation of devotees, because we give less time in our profession and we give more importance to our spiritual life, we might not be able to earn this much, and that's why we cannot give that much charity or that much donation to our temple. Now, even amongst, amongst the senior devotees also, there is one feeling in their mind that because we are not giving so much donation to our temple or not giving so much charity, they don't give us a recognition, or they don't feel it that, because they have one thing that once you go in grasa life or once you do profession, you have to give maximum. And because you are not giving maximum, you are not being recognized that way. So that is guilty type of a consciousness, that why that is so in that. We should be giving a full respect about whatever that has been given to them. Why is it so that that type of a thing is there in our congregation?
Who doesn't give respect?
Among the old devotees who are grasas, but they have that type of feeling. It is not among the brahmacharis, definitely no, because they have that simple life. But among the senior devotees, I see that type of feeling is there in their mind, that they have to give it. If they don't give it, that means they are not at all giving their full surrendered life to the activities of the temple.
Whether you are Hanuman or the spider, if you are giving the best you can, those who understand Krishna consciousness will appreciate that. You should give as much as you can for Krishna's service. Whether it's a little or a lot, it is said that Krishna does not see how much you give, he sees how much you hold back. So one is materialistic thinking and one is spiritual thinking. And besides, you should not be giving for distinction and respect. You should be giving as a service. If you're giving thinking, I will get, the more I give, the more I will be respected and adored for doing, then that means you are not really giving at all. You're giving with the improper motivation. So if you're not getting properly respected and you're giving as much as you can, you should take that as Krishna's mercy. That's a better reward. It will make you give with humility rather than give with pride. Jesus said that when you give with your right hand, your left hand should not see. We shouldn't be proud of how much we give. We shouldn't want to broadcast how much we give. We should simply want to please Krishna with what we give. We should not expect honor or recognition. It's like today is the disappearance day of Jayadev Goswami. There's a story in the life of Jayadev Goswami. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, Navadvip Mahatmya. He was living in Navadvip at Prithu Kund. And he was writing a beautiful poem. And somehow or other this poem was circulated, and it reached the king of Bengal, whose name was then Lakshman Sen, whose palace was not far away. And when Lakshman Sen was actually a very good devotee, he was actually a very, very great devotee of Krishna. And when he read this poem by Jayadev Goswami, he was just, tears were flowing from his eyes. It was so beautiful. He had never read such a masterpiece as this before. So he sent for his servant, who was actually the chief pundit of his court. His name was Govardhan. He called for him. He said, "Who has written this?" Govardhan read it. He said, "There is a great devotee named Jayadev, Jayadev Goswami. He must have written it. No one else could have written anything like this except him. Well, where is this Jayadev? I must see him. I must have his darshan." He said, he's living under a tree in a little hut made out of just broken wood that he has collected in the forest. He's living there with his wife, Padmavati. But he lives a very, very simple life. So the king decided that I must have the darshan. So he took off his crown, he took off all his royal clothes, and he dressed like a very poor man. And with bare feet, in the middle of the night, he went through the forest to Jayadev's little hut. Because he didn't want to present himself as being rich and learned and powerful to this great sage. He wanted to present himself as the most insignificant man. So he came to Jayadev Goswami's little hut, and he bowed down before him. Jayadev and his wife, there was some fire going, and they were just reading scripture together and like that. So when he came in, he bowed down, full prostrations, with great humility. And Jayadev saw him. He was not looking like an ordinary beggar. He had a big, massive, strong body. He was a kshatriya. And the way he spoke was with such aristocracy. So Jayadev said, "You are not a mendicant. You must be some sort of great aristocrat. Perhaps you are a prince or a king. Who are you?" So Lakshman Sen was thinking that when you come before a holy man, you cannot tell a lie. I must tell him the truth. He said, "My name is Lakshman Sen and I am the king of Bengal. But I have come to get your darshan." And he said, I request you, Jayadev, please make my life auspicious. Purify me from my sins by coming to visit my palace." Jayadev Goswami said, "I will never come to your palace, and I want no association with you, because you are a materialistic man. You are completely addicted to sense enjoyment and power and influence and prestige and worldly wealth." He said, "Therefore, I will never come to your palace, nor do I want anything to do with you. In fact, the fact that I am associating with such a materialistic man as you, I now vow that I'll cross the Ganges and I'll leave this place and go to Jagannath Puri." So Lakshman Sen became very humble by hearing this. And he said, "Well, everything you're saying about me is correct. That is right, but please do not leave Navadvip." He said, "You have already vowed to cross the Ganges." He said, "But there is a place called Champahata. It's a very, very beautiful little forest. Let us construct a nice hut for you there, a nice ashram for you there, for you and your wife, and you'll never have to come to my palace, and I promise I will not even come, you will never even see me. I'm so contaminated. But let me just do this favor for you and stay." And Jayadev, he said, "Actually, I only spoke this way of you, insulting you terribly, saying you were sinful, materialistic, attached to prestige, and well, I did that only to test you. If you retaliated or tried to defend yourself in any way, shape, or form, I would have left for sure. But because I see that you are very humble and very gentle and very devoted, even with all your wealth and everything," he said, "I am very pleased with you. Therefore, I will accept your offer. I will go and I will live in that hut in Champahata." And he said, "And you could come and visit me anytime you like. But to come to visit me, you have to come in the same dress you are now. You cannot come as a king. There should be no distinction when you come before a sadhu. So then Lakshman Sen became a very, very great devotee of Jayadeva Goswami, who accepted him like a disciple. So here was a man who was so powerful and so wealthy and so great, but Jayadeva saw that he was genuinely humble, and he was not attached to all those things. He was only attached to service and to satsang. That was the difference between Lakshman Sen and Mr. Rockefeller. You could have all material things and not be materialistic if you're humble. And if you're taking such guidance from great personalities. But then it is described that while Jayadeva Goswami was living there at Champahatta, he was very happy. One day, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared to him in a vision and said that 300 years from now, I am going to incarnate in Navadvip Dham, and I am going to spread the message of pure love of Radha and Krishna throughout the world by chanting, by propagating the Hari Nam Sankirtan movement, the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare. And Jayadeva Goswami was just in such loving ecstasy to see the beautiful form of Lord Gauranga. And he said, and not only that, Jayadeva, but you will write this book called Gita Govinda, and I will personally, in this incarnation of Sri Gauranga, I will personally every day taste the sweetness of the love of this beautiful poem. He said, but for now, you should leave Navadvip and reside in Jagannath Puri. And Jayadeva said to Mahaprabhu, look, why you want me to leave Navadvip? This place is my life and soul. Why are you casting me away? He said, no, not like that. He said, because Lord Jagannath wants your darshan. So you must go to serve Lord Jagannath. So then he and his wife went to Jagannath Puri. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu bestowed his causeless mercy upon him. There is another story about Jayadeva Goswami. When he was living with his wife Padmavati, one day he was writing one poem, and he was just inspired by Krishna to write this one line of how Krishna is so much under the control of Radharani's love that sometimes he bows at her lotus feet with his head. So he was thinking, how can I say this in writing? Because Krishna is the supreme controller. How can I say this about Krishna? So then he went to take his bath. And while he was gone, Krishna disguised himself as Jayadeva Goswami and came to the house and said, Padmavati, prasad is ready? She said, yes, yes. He said, just a few minutes. And he went to Jayadeva's writing table and he wrote that line that he was afraid to write. Krishna is bowing at the feet of Sri Radharani. And after that, his wife gave him prasad, and then he said, I have to go somewhere, and he left. And a few seconds later, the real Jayadeva came home. And he said, ah, prasad is ready? She said, it's finished. You already ate. What do you mean I already ate? Said, yes. So he said, well, so he went to his, so he couldn't understand. Oh, what his wife was saying, that he already ate prasad. So he went to sit and do his writing, and he saw in his own handwriting this verse that he specifically would not write was written exactly the way he thought of it. And then he said to his wife, "You are most fortunate that you were given the auspicious benediction of feeding Lord Krishna with your own personal hands, your prasad." So Krishna always fulfills the desires of his devotees in the most wonderful ways. Thank you very much.